Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Waxworks Wannabe, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And making her glorious FlixWise comeback, nay, return, is Oscar-nominated screenwriter of the 2015 film Carol, a.k.a. the best movie of the decade, Phyllis Nudge. Welcome back, Phyllis.
Well, thank you. That's quite an intro.
It's your return. I tell you, it's as if we never said goodbye. Yeah. It's the last reference we're going to make to that. Anyway, listeners, if you haven't yet heard our previous episode in which Phyllis and I go in depth on the making of Carol and then gush about a couple of Isabelle Huppert films, then I suggest you tee that up for when you're done with this episode. Anyway, I've managed to lure Phyllis back onto the show with the promise of discussing a certain 1950 Hollywood satire named for a major Los Angeles thoroughfare. But actually, I just have a screenplay I'd really like you to take a look at. Is it cool if it's handwritten?
Yeah, handwritten is nice and retro. Sure. I'd like that.
I kid. We are, in fact, here to revisit and discuss the 63rd movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Billy Wilder's Sunset Boulevard. Longtime listeners will recall that I once had Professor Joseph McBride on the show to chat about Wilder and some of the behind-the-scenes details of Sunset Boulevard. But now that we've officially come to where Sunset Boulevard is on the list, we're doing it again, and you know what that means. I get to dust off my Norma Desmond impression. So excited. Do you have a Norma Desmond impression?
I do not.
Are you sure?
I'm certain. And if I did, no one would want to hear
That's kind of, yeah. I don't mind whether anyone actually wants to hear it. I do it anyway. Yeah, I'll do it. It'll be interspersed through it, I'm sure. All right, but before we get out of hand with Norma Desmond impressions, I say we get started. What do you think, rubber or duplicate bridge?
Pass.
Pass.
Spade? Pass.
Three, no trump.
Pass.
Pass.
Empty the ashtray, will you, Joe, dear?
Okay. Today's topic is Billy Wilder's 1950 pitch black Hollywood satire, Sunset Boulevard. The film serves as a fable, a tale of specters and forgotten souls that will forever haunt the greater Los Angeles area, reminding all those bright-eyed kids fresh off the Greyhound that La La Land doesn't always reward talent and hard work with a happy ending. This ghost story was authored by Wilder and co-screenwriter Charles Brackett, and is narrated through the curled lip of one William Holden. Holden plays Joe Gillis, a failed screenwriter who just so happens to be recently deceased, and is regaling us with his story from beyond his watery grave. Joe sets the scene, narrating how one day he found himself face down, floating in a luxury pool on a massive Beverly Hills estate. Turns out it has something to do with a chance encounter with a movie star of yesteryear named Norma Desmond, who's played by Gloria Swanson. Apparently, the aged Norma used her cunning bank account and feminine wealth to lure poor unsuspecting Joe to his doom. Norma Desmond. You gotta say it like that, it's important. Norma Desmond, a jazz age actress, once the apple of every director's eye, has lost her shine and been abandoned, left to spend the remainder of her days rotting in an old mansion up on Sunset Boulevard. That is until Joe saunters into her house and has the audacity to demand free will and friends not named Norma. Both Joe and Norma are monstrous in their own special ways because they are products of a business that's content to exploit and manipulate people until they're no longer useful. At least that's what seems Wilder thought. He might have had an axe to grind, both with some of his bosses and perhaps with the public at large. But how well does this anti-entertainment industry message play today? We shall discuss. We can also discuss whether you think that's true. But let's first get to why we're really here, and that's to talk about Carol, always. I'm sure all of our listeners will recall that in one of the beginning scenes of Carol. Therese accompanies a group of young men to a movie theater where Sunset Boulevard is showing. So why Sunset Boulevard? Why out of all the films that came out in 1950 through 52 or so, why did you pick Sunset Boulevard? Just couldn't help yourself?
Well, Sunset Boulevard is like Hitchcock making an appearance in all of his films. I hope to find a place for it in every single film I have the good fortune to work on. But that particular scene was actually written into the script, the tango scene, and I'm thrilled that they actually use that.
So did you specify the scene?
Yes, the New Year's Eve scene. Yeah. Yeah.
That's perfect. So why that scene? First of all.
Oh, for so many reasons. Mm-hmm. It's such a it's one of my favorite scenes in the film. Full stop. Not only because it is a perfect illustration of subtext gone wrong, which is basically what's happening in Carol a lot of the time, but also because it's among the most meta scenes in Sunset Boulevard. Gloria Swanson really did dance a tango with Valentino, and John Seitz, the DP of Sunset Boulevard, shot Valentino and Alice Terry doing a tango in Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, which was Valentino's first film, right? It made him a star in any event. And so the things that are circulating around that scene are the kinds of things that will mean something to people who know about the minutiae of both Sunset Boulevard and the silent film era, both of which I know a lot about because I'm very sad.
I'm sure you mean interesting.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess I'm getting ahead of myself here. I take it you like Sunset Boulevard.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is my favorite film.
Okay.
And each time I see it, I'm just more confirmed in my belief that it is the perfect film.
Okay. Yeah.
In every single way.
Wow. Okay. I like that. So when did you first see it and what was your reaction?
Oh, well, I saw it for the first and only time I saw a print of Sunset Boulevard in a theater. It was at the Carnegie Hall Cinema in New York, and I was very young. I was there because it was part of a double bill, and I wanted to see the other film, and now I've since forgotten what it was. And the moment I saw that shot, I mean, first of all, the beginning of the film is wonderful. Not that that was the beginning of the film, but we get ahead of ourselves. But the shot of Joe in the pool, and I looked at that, and I thought, wow, this is clearly why people make movies. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I was just swept along by the rest of it, that first viewing. Mm-hmm. But I'm very happy that my first viewing of that film was on a big screen. It seemed appropriate. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned, as we were talking, we were exchanging emails before we recorded, that you like to revisit this film with some frequency, right?
Yeah.
How often would you say you rewatch it?
Probably once a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's like a religious ceremonial.
Yes, it is.
You know, you rewatched it for the show? I take it.
I sure did.
Yeah. What were some details you noticed this time that you hadn't noticed before?
Well, I was interested in I have certain thoughts about what Sunset Boulevard is and isn't that probably run counter to the received wisdom about it. And so my watch this time was to confirm or deny that this was going on, principally in watching the juxtaposition of performances, performance styles, and the way the camera was used. Right from the start this time, as I watched that famous opening shot, I notice that there is not any movement at all along Sunset Boulevard, save for the camera. The palms are preternaturally still. Everything is very still, going right into Norma's property. There's nothing that moves at all. Even the cops who are swarming, they're a swarm. The thing that moves first, really, in Sunset Boulevard is the water in the pool, which shouldn't be moving at all, mm-hmm. not really. So the focus on Joe Gillis being stock still amidst the waves is the first marker for me, for a film that is celebrating the anti-naturalism of film, and thus honoring its history. God, I don't mean that to sound vague and pretentious, but that's where I'm at with it right now. That there is an actual yearning or an elegiac nature to the film that isn't about cynicism. But for me, Wilder is the least cynical filmmaker, who I'm always reading is very cynical. Mm-hmm. There's a story about people, Hollywood execs, after the premiere of Sunset Boulevard, and there's one very famous one in particular is about Louis B. Mayer, cursing him and all of that. But really, the thought about Wilder at the time, even though he'd already won an Oscar, hadn't he, for Lost Weekend, was that he was vulgar. And that people like Brackett, who were not vulgar, and who were part of a boys' club, sort of enabled him to work, that this was the last film that he and Brackett worked on. Now, Wilder went on to many more successes, but they were of a different character, and they were received in a decidedly, increasingly hostile fashion. He was unsentimental always, and I think that is to this day often confused with cynicism. So that's my those are my opening salvos
okay.
here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's so much to take away from the film, and there's a lot to unpack. One hardly knows where to begin, but the beginning of the film seems like a worthy place. But yeah, the central sense of the movie is contained within that opening sequence. Briefly, I notice new things every time I watch it, and on this viewing, I never paid much attention to the apple and how Betty Shaffer, she's eating an apple when Joe enters her office, and she sort of playfully mock throws it at him, or gestures at throwing it at him. And then when they meet up again, they're eating apples, and Joe casually throws an apple onto the fake New York set or whatever. And I wondered if we could make anything of that. What is an apple?
Well, it's in keeping with the mock biblical themes running
yes,
throughout.
Indeed.
As I love how Norma Desmond says Salome. So in keeping with all of that, of course it would be an apple.
Yeah.
The temptation is there for the taking.
Sure.
I wonder if there are apples in the New Year's Eve party at Artie's. I don't recall.
Perhaps, yeah. But so let's talk about the perceived wisdom of the film. That, as you say, it's cynical. That this is a very sort of sharp, biting satire. Do we want to contest that at all? Do you think it's satirical? Is it more? Is it a documentary?
Well, I don't know. For me, it's too moving, ultimately, to be satirical. The empathy one feels for all of them at various points, mm-hmm. is too rooted. Now, there have been a lot of people over the years who've claimed credit for various things, including the empathetic base for Norma. Gloria Swanson has hinted around that, you know, she was responsible for some of that. The great von Stroheim for others. But basically, I think that's a case of everyone claiming credit for something that was more successful than probably the studio thought it would be. I think all credit to Paramount in some way for actually letting it go ahead. And with about 25 or so pages of shooting script at the beginning.
Right.
I mean, would that happen today? I don't know. I'd like to think it wouldn't, because it's just a little too real. I also will speak up for the third often forgotten contributor to that screenplay, D.M. Marshman, who was brought in at some point, apparently to help with story structure, which is key. Now, we don't know exactly what he contributed, and it's clearly bracket dialogue, Wilder's jokes, bracket translates, right? But Marshman, the plotting of Sunset Boulevard is so precise that every gesture, every action is rooted in a previous script choice. So, for instance, things as small as when Betty Schaefer's leaving the Desmond estate for the last time, for the first and last time, mm-hmm. And Joe walks her out and he opens the gate and he says to her, "And by the way, if you and Artie ever want to, you know, come and wait, there's a pool," mm-hmm. and he switches on the light, which is really necessary for the final. Yeah. There were moments like that all over this film that were never present in the looser structures of Brackett and Wilder, and certainly not in Diamond Wilder. Mm. So I have to think that Marshman, whoever he was,
the unsung hero.
He only had one other screen credit, I think.
Hmm.
I think he's got something pretty major to do with the way that came together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People often accuse Wilder of kind of putting the script first above the visuals. But I don't know, and particularly in this case, I don't know that that's fair, because this is such a visually striking work.
I don't think it's ever fair. I think that's ridiculous to think that a script isn't the foundation of any film. Mm-hmm. But he was a great visual stylist. What he wasn't was a show-off. I suppose the pool shot is the most show-offy thing in the film. And the strange use of zooms, which in this film they are used in, no matter what they are, optical or not, they're used in very interesting ways, and as a sort of strange recreation of an iris effect almost. So the theme of and the use of dissolves we could devote an entire afternoon to. Mm-hmm. But they were so carefully put together, the visuals. They were so integrated into what happens with the narrative, that I guess maybe people find it boring. I'm not sure. But I do think that's unfair. I think he was a great stylist, mm-hmm. and certainly in a movie like Sunset Boulevard, which is elevating the artificial in order to arrive at a naturalism, I think it's very advanced. So
yeah.
Certainly we don't have 90s music video stylings going on in here, or even the sort of cruder zooms of the 70s, but we've got something going on there.
Yeah, he manages to be both sort of unassuming and baroque at the same time. There are so many gorgeous, heavily, like really detailed shots. Like there are shots of von Stroheim playing the organ while the foreground is his fingers, while background is Norma or various characters, a lot of deep focus. So there's clearly a lot of care and attention paid to the visuals. And that's true throughout his entire career. I mean, The Apartment, the use of deep focus in there is beautiful. I don't quite understand where that's coming from.
He has this sort of eye of a still photographer. There's a depth of focus that is very, very journalistic as well, in a funny way. So he's documenting everything, which seems right in this movie. And sometimes in other movies it doesn't, particularly the later movies. But this one it really does. And also, it allows his actors great latitude. So whilst everything seems precisely blocked in this, I have a feeling, I don't know this for sure, but I think they had great latitude within the basic setup of the scene. Obviously they couldn't walk to the other room, but, you know, everything is planned. From the light, the doors that have no locks or knobs or anything like that, and the way that light is used throughout. I mean, how could you not respond to the real visual nature of the way the story is being told?
Absolutely, yeah. Let's talk about some of the nods to the silent era that you mentioned in your opening remarks, specifically as it pertains to Norma Desmond and Gloria Swanson. How do you feel about Norma Desmond, the character? Do you pity her? Do you admire her? Is it some combination of both?
Well, I like what Nancy Olson, who obviously played Betty, and who I think gives that is the hardest role in the film, and she's absolutely terrific. And she was robbed of every single award. That is not easy. But I loved what she had to say about the relationship of the characters to each other, and as it particularly pertains to Norma, that it's a film about opportunism and its consequences. And Norma, as C.B. DeMille himself says, was promised certain things. You were promised certain things. It's like belonging to a union or a faculty. You sign on and your people take care of you. And in this business, in Sunset Boulevard, no one took care of anyone. Mm. So they were all equally culpable and all equally flawed and human. What's heartbreaking about Norma is, for me, and which is why I come down on the side of quite liking her, I don't know if I admire her or, but I like her, and I would rather play bridge with her than probably anyone else in the film.
Except Buster Keaton.
Oh, yeah. Or any of those waxworks.
Sure. Yeah.
Norma, just from that little brilliant section of Queen Kelly that we watch now, in that little throwaway nothing moment from Queen Kelly, you see what kind of actress Gloria Swanson and Norma Desmond was back in the day. That's the film that destroyed both she and von Stroheim. That's another thing. But there was an incredible naturalism to her performance in Queen Kelly that you don't see in The Gishes or, you know, hardly anyone else, maybe Mary Pickford from time to time, but she was a real good actress. And what Norma became, and it's part of the reason I love Swanson's performance in this, she became a constructed version of what people wanted her to be. So Swanson's performance is all gestural, and it's all harking back to what people believed the silence were. But from time to time, you see the facade slip. You see the woman she was and what her career and what Hollywood made her become. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just an exquisitely controlled performance, that the only time anyone manages to puncture it, basically, is when Joe suggests that her fan mail isn't real.
Yeah.
So it's really Max that can stick the knife in. Mm. But I don't think that she does anything in the film that any woman in her position who had her level of fame probably wouldn't have done,
mm-hmm.
including going a little loopy.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah, it's the gestures, the body language are all, they so perfectly make up the character. But you're right that when you watch Gloria Swanson in interviews, you realize that that entire character is affected. That is not who Gloria Swanson is. That is not who she was.
And it wasn't who Norma was, yeah, as an actress.
Yeah, exactly. It's fascinating. And I guess is the idea that she became this way because just festering resentment, or and so like her whole body's kind of gnarled. She's you can see it in her fingers, most notably, is like everything sort of curls up. Her hair is curled up. Everything seems to be a kind of a manifestation of this this sort of rejection. Like maybe she has internalized it. I don't know.
It's rejection.
Yeah.
It's armor. It's, you know, you can see it playing out today with certain, let's say, waning careers in every walk of life, and the way that people arm themselves and batten down the hatches against the impending, you know, death, metaphorically and literally, is to become almost a caricature of the thing that people thought you were.
Mm.
But they have no idea, because they weren't there, mm-hmm. when you were really in your heyday.
Mm.
And so she becomes this, I see it as an act of defiance, that there is this performance that certainly Swanson concocted. I do not think this was dictated to her. Everything I know about the film says that she made these choices herself. If this is what you think of my era, I'm going to do it to the 10th.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to remain there because this is where I was my happiest. But, which is why she watches, I think, her films continually, not because she's a monster or an egotistical monster, which, I mean, you know, perhaps she is. Who isn't?
Mm.
It's because she is reminded continually of what she was, which was, on evidence of what we see, a pretty damn good naturalistic actress in an era where there was a whole lot of BS in performance.
Mm.
And it's striking that Wilder chose, for the Waxworks, three of the best, most naturalistic of silent film performers.
Mm.
Which, by the way, do you know how much those people were paid?
I have no idea.
Okay. Some things never change.
Yeah.
I wrote this down. H.B. Warner actually was paid the most.
Oh, shocking.
I guess maybe because he played Jesus Christ. I don't know. But he was paid a total of $1,250 for a day.
Uh-huh.
And it was broken into a weird, like, for half a day, he was paid $1,250. Sorry. Buster Keaton was paid $1,000, and Anna Q. Nielsen was paid $200.
Well,
there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, sigh. I hadn't really thought about how that Norma Desmond would sort of manifest this version of herself because she wanted to live up to people's expectations. That makes a lot of sense. That wasn't actually a natural outgrowth of her silent film era persona. That's just sort of what happened because she was trying to please other people.
Yeah,
that's fascinating.
And it has a payoff, which is that she is spared the indignity of reality at the end of the film.
Yeah.
She does get to act again. And she does, actually, if you listen to her in that scene, she's her most naturalistic in voice. Mm. You know, what is the scene?
Yeah.
It's the only time that Max refers to her as Norma instead of Madame.
Mm-hmm.
And when she says her famous line, you know, to the director, I'm ready, you know, ready for my close-up.
Mm-hmm.
It's very simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And because she is finally Salome, we see what she's been rehearsing for her entire life with those outsized gestures and the physical control. It makes perfect sense. And so there's a vindication, if anything, by Wilder, even if he didn't mean it. But Norma has not spent the last 20 years fruitlessly.
Mm. I never quite know how to read that last sequence, because is it her great triumph, or is it just purely pathetic? I never see it as pathetic, because I have a hard time seeing her as pathetic. I feel tremendous sympathy for her, and I just think she's such a great, just outsized personality that I absolutely would want to hang out with her. And Joe's sort of rejection and cynicism is a little off-putting and curious. Like, I watch her and I just think she's magnificent. And he's so kind of rude.
Well, it's interesting, because at the end of Sunset Boulevard, what Norma's fate is almost exactly the end of A Streetcar Named Desire. Almost exactly. And I am sure Wilder must have seen the play, right?
It was a big hit.
There is a parallel. So I suppose if one finds Blanche pathetic, which people rarely do, one might find Norma pathetic. I think it's easier to find her pathetic because she's a Hollywood person, which, of course, is ridiculous. That she is granted her descent, her final descent, to be the role she always wanted to play, seems like an enormous act of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's brilliant because it can be interpreted in many different ways, but she whites out.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't black out. That dissolve is innocent.
Mm-hmm.
It's right back to the beginning. And yes, it can be read purely cynically, I suppose, but that would be ignoring all of the small kindnesses that are going on throughout. And even Joe, I mean, arguably, he could have just walked out of that house. He did Betty a great service mm-hmm. in sending her on her way. He did go back to, he did eventually consummate his relationship with Norma on New Year's Eve. He didn't have to. Mm-hmm. There is something decent about Joe, and yet he behaves like most desperate screenwriters, right? I mean, there's jokes about us because, some of that is true. Like, he will take money from whoever. And the thing that I wondered about this time around, which I hadn't given much thought to before, it's like, I'm not sure Joe Gillis is very talented.
Right, I wondered about that.
I think that Betty's freshness and optimism and her belief, as she comes from showbiz, a showbiz family, her belief that there is good, that world can change, etc., with what we do, what they do. Joe does not share that belief. His tragedy is that I don't think he ever understood that he wound up where he should have been with a relic of a bygone era. He's not even interested in Max. Once he understands who Max is, it would be like, you know, what was it? The three great young directors were Griffith, Max, and some other. But anyway, Joe doesn't even register.
Yeah.
So I think, wow, he's a callow ass, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
But what's great about the pairing of them, here's Swanson constructing this great ode to artificiality, to anti-naturalism, to all the things that film does best. And there's Holden, who's so real, and such the new generation of actors, that he looks wan in comparison. So Wilder, whether or not this was... And Betty Schaefer is something else entirely, and so is Max. So is von Stroheim. And whether or not he intended it, it's like some sort of primer in acting from the turn of the century to, well, 1949, sure, when it was. And the way that the... And what triumphs in the end is that both the silent film director and the silent film actress are allowed to work again.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, there are very few ways in which you can take that, I think. And one of them is not that he's making fun of them.
Mm. Yeah, there's far too much humanism. Like, Billy Wilder is an essentially humanist director. And I think it's a lament for the lost stars of this era. I don't think he's mocking her. Yeah.
Or he may have meant to. Who knows?
True.
I mean, we don't know what's in someone's mind.
Sure.
But what we see, I think your response to Norma Desmond as a viewer determines what your response to the film is. If all you see is a conniving woman, and you don't see the equally conniving gigolo,
mm-hmm,
well, that says something, too.
Sure, yeah.
But one of the saddest things in this film is that her Max, a great director, as von Stroheim was, is so enamored of her that even though she divorced him, even though blah, 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 and he's running around wearing white gloves... he's still there. Now, this means something.
Mm-hmm.
What it means is not necessarily that he had nowhere else to go, because we don't know that. We know admirably little about both their careers. We know what we need to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, sorry, the third director was DeMille.
It was DeMille,
right?
Who's there,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, we know that Max could have had a career.
Yeah.
And there was a path he could have taken where he could have survived the transition from the silent to the talkies, but he chose instead to remain in the past.
Yeah.
What do you make of the interpretation of Sunset Boulevard as kind of a camp classic? I think... No dice.
Yeah. I'm, you know, I think there has to be, the level of awareness and archness that's necessary for that is not present in one single frame of that film.
Mm.
I think it's probably a late 20th century take on it, right? And it's not actually seeing a film in its proper context, when it was made, at what point in this person's career was it made. It was Billy Wilder at possibly his most powerful, and then he chose to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing points to it being a camp enterprise at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's flamboyant in a way. It's over the top.
I don't know. Maybe I just know too many people like this that are in the film that it seems a bit sedate to me. I mean, we all have well, not all of us, but we do come across women like Norma, and they're not necessarily actresses. They're grand dames. They're you know, someone's. I used to know. I had an aunt who was the wife of a diplomat, and she certainly wasn't from any money. But over the years, she took on this sort of. As my mom used to say, "What's that phony accent?" You know. there's an affectation, certainly, about Norma in this movie. But in order for it to qualify for camp for me, things have to be slightly out of place in a heightened way. So within the context of her house and her domain, there's nothing that's out of place. Yes, there is that servant. Yes, look at the furnishings. If you believe that story about Seitz blowing... magnesium dust around to make it look even more sure. I get it. The monkey, I mean, there is the monkey works, but that's the one area where, you know, I think Billy Wilder was being intentionally provocative and vulgar when people would ask him, and he'd say, yes, she's fucking the monkey, which, you know, Gloria Swanson wisely, you know, just ignored it. But none of it seems out of place. Nothing is being called, attention isn't being called to it, except within the context of the narrative. You know, what is that line Max has when Holden is going up the stairs for the first time? If you need any help with the coffin, call me. You know. Now, there is a reason why that is said, and there is a dead animal up there. Sure. He loved. He always loved fire and poking at it with a stick. There's Billy Wilder's what I guess Hollywood would call his vulgarity back in the day, but really it's just life. It's just a sort of exuberance. That's his. You know, that was part of his. Thing. But it wasn't out of place, and it wasn't being, nothing was being inserted to make you necessarily laugh at these people. The monkey's funeral was sort of heartbreaking. So no, I'm not on board with the whole camp. I mean, I think there's more of a case to be made for All About Eve being camp than this.
I think that that's probably true as well. But I mean, Swanson's interpretation of Norma, and maybe this is intentional with it, the character is herself kind of just such an exaggerated version of femininity that maybe that is where that's coming from. There's no, this is a kind of, it's such a heightened portrayal of a person, particularly a female person. It's so,
but it's sort of a deconstruction of it. I mean, think about what were her, were there any precedents for this at the time? Of this kind of portrayal?
None that I can think of offhand.
Well, I can't think of it offhand. I mean, maybe in some of Joan Crawford's more heightened, you know, when was Sudden Fear made? A movie that I love, but I don't know enough about.
That was made in 1952.
Okay, so people were imitating Norma.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Or maybe some of Barbara Stanwyck's stuff where, you know, there is an awareness of what being a woman is in the film. But what Gloria Swanson had to rely on there was watching her own friends go through this. I mean, honestly, and she was friendly with a fair number of these older, you know, by this time older 50s silent film stars, and looking what happened to them. Like maybe Nazimova was doing this on screen. But I think Gloria Swanson was creating a real person.
and deconstructing what it meant, which I think is not what's going on in camp, obviously camp portrayals of things. You know, Faye Dunaway and Mommy Dearest, mm-hmm. that's another story. But I just don't see it within the context of film history to that point. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it's interesting to me, did anyone, you know, what's her name? Fellini's early muse, Giulietta
Messina. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, to me, mm-hmm. that's camp. Like, a lot of that early stuff
is Lestrada?
Camp. And I know it's not meant to be.
Sure.
But I look at the what I consider to be the artificiality of that kind mm-hmm. of thing, the mm-hmm. wide eyes. It's very manufactured. Mm-hmm. And I respond to that more in that vein than I do Norma Desmond, who she is actually... anything she does is not layered onto that script. That this is what she is, you know? Mm-hmm. That kind of, you know, is it a woman? Who? You know? Like, mm-hmm. what... Her choices there are to be pathetic. No, don't leave me, Joe. Don't leave me. Who? Who is it? Or to be the strong, willful character that she's written as. So that's why I keep saying there's a naturalism about her performance that is helping to build the anti-naturalism in it. It's like, screw this. This is what movies can do. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to show you how we command a screen. And it's all to get her to the end, which is like, good writing works. Mm-hmm. Like, you think, why is that going on? Oh, I get it. And that's how I felt the first time I saw Sunset Boulevard. And still, when she makes that final descent down the staircase, it all comes together for me. Mm-hmm. That's what that performance is leading to, and that's why it's heartbreaking, and that's why it's not camp. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because it's all in service of the character's fate, which is to play Salome.
Do you,
if you look at it in that particular way, then to me it makes sense.
On a slightly different topic, but also related, do you think whatever happened to Baby Jane is campy? Do you give it a camp read?
I guess. Yeah. I mean, I think that Bette Davis's, well, both their performances in that are so extraordinary. Mm. And coming from the theater, you know, there is nothing unusual about heightened reality. I think every time someone does something that's a little heightened, it doesn't mean it's camp. I think that's an overlay and one area of critical theory that I just wish would go away. Because I think there are very few things that, to me, qualify. And that, for me, camp is a pejorative as well. Mm. That it means, on some level, if you're applying it to a book or a film or a piece of art, that it is fundamentally without emotional subtext, without meaning in that way. Mm. Lots of other kinds of things might be going on. And Baby Jane, to me, I mean, it's nowhere near the film that Sunset Boulevard is or any of those movies in 1950, but it has an integrity, it has a coherence and a desire not to mock the audience that maybe elevates it out of there, and it's like Bette Davis just committing to what's on the page. Mm-hmm. So probably the campiest performance in there is what's his name, Victor Buono.
Yeah,
you know, that's probably the campiest performance in that film. I think those two ladies are trying to be real. In their way.
Yeah, I guess it's helpful to have one definition of camp, and I don't know that we've ever kind of come to a consensus on that.
Well, I don't know about Sondheim, but still,
Yeah. Yeah. I think of Swanson and Bette Davis and Crawford as being there is a real commitment. And I don't think I think they love their characters. And I think they fully inhabit those characters. There isn't an emotional remove from any of those performances. I don't think anyone is mocking those characters. I get the same sort of visceral reaction from both movies, which is I understand that some people respond negatively to these women, but I just adore them. Yeah. And I wonder, I was trying to think, what is it exactly that draws me to them? And I realized that there is a kind of power that comes from being that sort of scary, specifically to men. And they don't have to they don't threaten violence really, only to themselves. But it's really just being able to be so almost grotesque that it's off-putting to men. And I think that's amazing. It's a really powerful thing to watch.
It also has to do with control. Mm. I mean, certainly Norma and I suppose Baby Jane, they have accepted the fact that they can exert control in one way or another. Mm. Norma controls her very body in order to walk down those stairs at the end. And her money is a form of control. And it's very rare in cinema to see that being utilized quite so openly. The year after Sunset Boulevard, we saw a different take on that in Elizabeth Taylor's performance in A Place in the Sun. And it's why I maintain that Elizabeth Taylor remained so popular is because she knew how not to make it obvious that she was in control. Mm-hmm. But she always was. But backing up to Norma, she did not mind taking control. Now, you want to see that as manipulative, that's fine. But we have a whole slew of male parts to follow in the decades that come. Wall Street, anything from Wall Street Traders to Daniel Day-Lewis and There Will Be Blood, just grotesquely manipulative, constructed performances. I mean, they're great performances, but mm-hmm. I mean, these characters are every bit as grotesque as, say, Norma Desmond, if you're on that wavelength. Mm-hmm. And yet, they are never spoken about in quite the same way. You would never say Daniel Day-Lewis's portrayal of that character is camp. Mm-hmm. And yet, I dare say it is.
It might be.
Yeah. It might be.
Yeah, I think you're right.
There's also that. It is that woman taking that kind of control and having a male character, which Joe Gillis does understand the currency, the transactional nature of it, and submits to it, as does Monty Clift later in A Place in the Sun. Mm-hmm. And so this is the thing that's dangerous. This is the thing that I think maybe makes people in some way want to push Sunset Boulevard out of the realm of what's possible into the realm of what's fanciful, i.e. camp.
Yeah.
And that's why All About Eve doesn't get it, because they were clever enough to have a disappointed female lead, mm-hmm. Character. Mm-hmm. Like, she doesn't get what she wants.
That's true.
Does she?
No.
No.
Well, there's some dispute, I guess.
Well, yeah. But she gets what's best for her.
Yeah.
Whether or not that's what any actress wants, I would probably dispute. Mm. But Norma gets what she's wanted.
Yeah.
To play Salome. Mm. Yeah. And to be spared going to jail. She's just making a movie. Mm-hmm. She's working.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of making movies, you've made a movie or two.
How has working in the movie business kind of affected your how you see the film and your interpretation of it?
Wow. Well, I do see some of what I would consider to be the, you know, the Norma Desmond syndrome going on, but not so much with actors, with other people, with writers or directors or people who let's say think they've had their day, and then 15 years later, because it's so difficult to make another movie, there is that kind of, I'm going into someone's office and it's littered with old posters of, you know, successes in 1972. Mm-hmm. And that's what they talk about. But at least now, everybody has the option to migrate to streaming or television or... thankfully, there's less chance I'm going to run into Norma Desmond now, and yet somehow more of a chance that they're going to be women of a certain age, and that certain age shifts. I mean, it was 50 then. Now it's like what, 35 or who knows what it is, 40.
Yeah.
But that cynicism of the script writer is something that I don't see, and I sort of wish I did see more of it. Yeah. I see a complete, you know, like everything is great, and, you know, the rise of the comic book movie and all of that. It's like, that's fine. It's just...
Yeah. Like, sunny... Just jingoistic optimism. Yeah.
It's a phase.
Yeah, we'll see.
But yeah, the cynicism that sort of people think that Joe Gillis sort of is the proxy for Billy Wilder, because he's pretty cynical and he's a screenwriter. There are some parallels. But I think talking to you now, like, I realize maybe it's a mistake to equate the two. Like, he is not a mouthpiece for Billy Wilder.
Oh, I think Norma's the mouthpiece. Mm. I really do.
Yeah.
Not Max. And it certainly wasn't the DeMille of the script. I mean, DeMille, I'm very, very glad that C.B. DeMille played himself, because that magnificent sequence where Norma comes to face to face with the sound era, with the microphone and the lights, and is, I was very happy that C.B. DeMille decided to argue with Wilder on certain points, certain script notes, certain things that just shifted slightly, made it very clear that there was great understanding of Norma and her predicament. But that whole thing is wild with C.B. DeMille directing Samson and Delilah, wearing exactly what he wore to direct things. I mean, the whole thing is like some sort of postmodern examination of film history.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's a case to be made that many of the films made in this era are kind of this postmodern examinations of stories that they had told in the previous decade, because 1940s, you have the post-war era, and you're sort of still reeling from the effects of the war. And as you move into the 50s, it's this transitionary period. And with that, I mean, you can characterize Sunset Boulevard as a film noir, but there's something distinct about it, in that it is a kind of... It's a postmodernist version of a noir. It is very aware of the tropes that it is utilizing, and it uses them for kind of it's like a psychological noir, which, as we would see later, more and more in the 1950s, as you mentioned, Sudden Fear. That's a prime example. It's perfect. Do you? I don't know if you pay any mind to these sort of genre demarcations, but do you consider this a film noir?
It's like a, it's a, what I, it's a, noir shot in broad daylight. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, we think of the, you know, the two famous nighttime scenes in this, the end or the penultimate scene, and the studio walk lot scene, in which Franz Waxman, the other great contributor to this, set the whole theme, musical theme of it, on its head. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think a lot of the, this is a jaundiced view of Hollywood, comes from, that beautiful, really setting his musical theme through a cracked mirror and using the Paramount newsreel music throughout it too. That's where a lot of this comes from, I think. But if you take that away and look at what's going on in those nighttime scenes, they are the only real nighttime scenes that you're aware of it being night. Mm-hmm. Most of it is the speeding down sun with the curtains shut, mm-hmm. and people working and people shutting out the real horror of L.A., mm. which is not the nighttime, but the daylight, mm. because in the daylight, you see yourself.
Yeah.
Norma, you know, there's that one mirror, isn't there, at the end. Yeah. But still, Norma's not looking at herself during the day, but neither is Joe, neither is Max, mm-hmm. really.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's as dark as it comes, but not... but dark in the sunshine, which is something different. This is, I don't know of any other film noir that's, well, maybe a bit of Double Indemnity, which of course he also made.
Right, yeah. This is a very, you know, self-reflexive. You're looking at the mirror. It is a reflection. The shot, the opening shot, the famous opening shot, is a shot of a mirror. In order to get the shot of Joe Gillis floating, they shot it on...
And we don't get that tracking shot in the... At night. I mean, it doesn't look like night, mm-hmm. does it?
Mm.
Looks like day.
Yeah.
Mm. It's weird.
Yeah.
But it is day.
Yeah.
You know, by the time they get there.
Sure. Yeah.
Dawn, probably.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about sort of the influence of this film and how that sort of plays into its legacy. Do you see, I mean, there's some obvious kind of influences that you, the player comes to mind. But can you think of other ways that this film is kind of, has it seen its legacy kind of rise?
Well, I think for good and bad, the way in which female characters of vulnerability, who are also artists of any kind, it doesn't matter if it's film actresses or singers. I'm thinking specifically of Piaf, where you can see the desire not to be Norma Desmond going on in that performance. I think there are a lot of people clearly who have been influenced by Wilder in general, but Sunset Boulevard in particular, in terms of maybe theme, but I'm not sure anybody's really, I mean, I'm trying to think who's actually, maybe Cameron Crowe, but that's different.
I don't know. Yeah. David Lynch.
In terms of writing, I mean, apart from anything else, he and his writing partners, whoever wrote those scripts, were great writers. And what's interesting is that I never hear about that. You know, I hear about people earlier who are great writers, people who hold up Preston Sturges and Lubitsch and people like that. And yes, they were great writers. Mm-hmm. But Wilder and company were too.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why that is. Maybe it's because there's a lack of... You can't really characterize them. They don't fit neatly into that cinema studies mold of things. Is it a comedy? Yeah, maybe. But is it a drama? Yes, it is. Is it satire? Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot characterize any of his films. Is Stalag 17 a war movie? No. Well, no. Yeah, sort of.
Mm.
Is The Apartment a romance? It's one of the most romantic films I've ever seen, but there's nothing nice that's going on in it, really. So I think it's very hard for people to claim Wilder as an influence when they really can't peg that influence. I think there's a lot of Europeans who are much more willing to claim him, and yet if you talk about Wilder to anybody, a group of people, oh yeah, of course. And he wasn't afraid of being messy. There's some certain things about Sunset Boulevard that are messy, and they work. But he wasn't afraid of it. He wasn't afraid of being vulgar and populist, mm-hmm. which I think are two things that often cinephiles reject. Mm.
Yeah.
Which I think shouldn't be rejected.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's that's interesting. So the auteur theory has kind of helped to sort of not dismantle, but kind of just diminish his legacy, which is a shame.
Yeah.
That needs to be rethought. But I do think that these things are cyclical and he'll eventually come back around because he's great.
I mean, I was surprised to see that the only Wilder that I'm aware of in the Criterion collection is Ace in the Hole.
Is that the only one?
Well, oh, I think so. I think it is.
Oh, my God.
That well, could very well
I
be.
I ordered it, you know, and so I was looking.
Wow.
But, you know.
That's appalling. Get on it. Yeah. What are they doing over there?
I would like a really good restoration and of Sunset Boulevard, a really good, you know, package. There aren't, to my knowledge, there aren't. I have a couple of special editions, but the format's annoying. Mm. Or,
yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to yell at them about that.
All right. Last question. This is the obligatory canon question. This is the 63rd movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Is that high? Is that low?
I'm going to guess that's
low. How many are there?
There are
100?
Well, there are 250 on the list.
No, it's low.
That's low.
It's low.
That's way too
it's
low.
It's very low.
What are we doing?
Like, if it were my Sight and Sound list, this would be number one.
Mm.
And All That Jazz would be number two.
Okay.
So
okay. They should ask you.
Well, they don't. But
I'm going to yell at them.
Yeah, yell at them.
Put in a word.
But yeah, no. Wherever it should land, it shouldn't be number 63.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot think, I'm sure, of 63 films, even worldwide, that deserve to be placed higher than this. Does he have anything else on the list?
Yeah, Some Like It Hot is actually higher.
No.
Yeah.
I love Some Like It Hot, but not higher than
absolutely
this.
No. I know. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a case to be made. Like, The Apartment is my
top three, Apartment so. Is... that's not on the list?
Yeah, it's got to be on the list. I just think it's...
It doesn't have to be. I mean, you know.
That would be a shame.
But there are so many. That's the thing about him. When you start really thinking about it, like, Ace in the Hole is a great film. It's underseen.
Sure.
Stalag 17 is a great film. Double Indemnity. I'm like, where do you stop?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a fan of The Lost Weekend, I will just say, that I think it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, I mean, they're not all mad. I'm not a huge fan of Love in the Afternoon.
No, and certainly I'm not a fan of Fedora and anything that came. But Fedora, of course, has that shot that's a nod to Sunset Boulevard. Now, that's camp.
Mm.
That whole thing is camp. But I think he wanted to stop making that film like a day after he started shooting it.
Yeah, the last few are not.
He was extremely old.
He was in his 80s still making movies. Or maybe it was 80.
Good for him.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know, amazing. But that's to wrap things up, way too low.
Way too low.
Way too low.
That's enough darkness for one episode. So, let's get out of noir territory. Let's not let Joe Gillis's cynicism permeate this whole show. Let's close things out with some final notes of positivity. Phyllis, what's one piece of culture, pop or otherwise, that you've been digging lately or that you'd love unabashedly?
No cynicism.
All right. Well, I'm going to drag us back to the darkness for this one.
Oh, no.
Which is the final season of The Leftovers, which is, wow, what can I say about this show? I have loved it for all three of its seasons, all of them discreet and different. I admit that after the second season, I had no idea how they were going to make a season that was better than that, and yet they did. It is the best television show I have seen since The Sopranos.
Okay.
So I, without hesitation, unreservedly recommend this to anyone who's looking at not only content, but the way form is used in dramatic writing and film and TV making.
Mm-hmm. I have to admit, I'm a little bit skeptical just because I was not a fan of Lost.
No, neither was I.
Okay.
Yeah, neither was I. So I will say that.
Okay.
This is not Lost.
Okay. All right. I think you've convinced me. I've been debating whether or not I should start it, and now I will. Yeah. Promise. I will check back in with you. So I thought I would just talk a little bit about Los Angeles for a second. It takes a little bit of a beating in Sunset Boulevard, but I'm here to stick up for it. This fair city of angels.
Right.
This is my hometown, and there's so much that I love about it. And I'm leaving soon in a few weeks. Yeah.
Oh no.
I know. I'll be back. But just before I go, I wanna sign out with a couple of recommendations for what you should do if you are in town and you wish to avoid all of the Hollywood nonsense. So number three, go to a Dodger game.
Absolutely.
I think you can co-sign that. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Chavez Ravine is like the great cultural melting pot of the city.
And baseball fans, it is the most beautiful ballpark in the country, and I've been to most of them.
Wow. It is also the third oldest.
It's the only OL Wrigley and Fenway.
Wrigley and Fenway,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is gorgeous.
Bring your own food.
Yeah.
I will say that it falls down on the roster of ballpark food.
What, you don't like the Dodger dogs? What do you mean? Sacrilegious.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Don't eat any of that stuff. number two, go to any local taqueria. It's going to be delicious. My personal favorite is Taco Miendo, but and I also like the El Chato truck that is close to where we're recording now on Olympic and La Brea. But basically any small, locally owned taco restaurant will serve you well. And then number one, my favorite thing to do is to go to Casablanca.
You can go to Casablanca. Really? in Venice, California, believe it or not. There's a restaurant. It's not Moroccan, which is a shame. But they do have the best margaritas in town and the best tortillas. But the draw is that the whole place is covered. Every square inch of it is covered in Casablanca memorabilia. And it's the kitschiest place in town. Those are my three.
I've never been. I'll have to go.
Oh my god, I will. You're coming.
Okay.
We're going. Okay, that is happening. So yeah, and it's just basically Los Angeles is amazing, and it's more than Hollywood, and so much of people's idea impression of it is formed by movies, and it doesn't always get the best rap. But I'm here to tell you, it's a great, great place to live. Anyway, that's my final note. Also, Phyllis, you mentioned Sudden Fear. That's a great, great film.
It really is a great film.
It's so, so good. And
It's for those who have yet to see it. Joan Crawford plays a playwright who is probably the best-dressed playwright you'll ever meet. Takes place in San Francisco, and you haven't lived until you've seen Joan Crawford running up and down like the steepest hills in a pair of high heels and a fur coat. And I think that's all we'll say. I'll say about it.
Yeah.
I won't ruin it.
Watch it. It's on Filmstruck. Watch it now. Mm-hmm.
that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, I'm sure you have thoughts on Sunset Boulevard you'd like to share. Come post them on our website, flickswise.com. And you can like us and leave us a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. And if you want to continue gushing about Los Angeles and its variety of great cultural attractions, you should probably come find me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. And that's also the best way to find out info on upcoming episodes. But before you do all of that, please, please soothe these fraying nerves of mine and go to iTunes. There you can subscribe, rate us, and leave us a nice comment. And if you don't, well, I'll do it again. I couldn't help it. I had to do it. And on that note, Phyllis, thank you so much for coming on the show again.
It's my pleasure. Always. Anytime.
We will find you another movie, trust. But until then, shall we go for a swim?
Oh, God, yes, in this heat? Sure.
Exactly.